Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Recently, I sent out an audio message about the myth of German military superiority in World War II, wherein I focused on the lies that the Germans had these overwhelming numbers of tanks, overwhelming numbers of troops, that the Germans were like the modern Americans who send huge fleets. They've got almost unlimited amounts of ammunition and all that kind of rubbish. This is a complete and utter myth about the Germans, and I quickly summarized it in that audio. And I just want to carry on with a related topic, because there are many things that white people do not understand about themselves, do not understand about their culture, do not understand about their history. This is not just true for the whites of Africa, that the whites of Africa have completely lost contact with the European way of doing things. It is also true for whites in America, Canada, whites across the Western world, and even the whites in Europe themselves. Whites have completely and utterly forgotten about how we do things, and not only how we do it, but more importantly, why we do things the way we do. Because there are very important reasons and lessons as to why we do things this way, and why this way is the best way. I went and checked, and what I had said in that audio was totally correct, that 75 to 80% of the German army in World War II, the greatest war machine the world has ever seen, that 75 to 80% of the German army in World War II walked on foot and were supplied by horses. The Germans used 2.7 million horses in World War II. The only people who used more horses than the Germans were the Russians, who used more than 3 million horses in World War II. Part of the reason also is the horrific state of the Russian roads, which even in modern times will shock you. And if you had to see what the German army had to contend with, people have no idea the kinds of obstacles the Germans faced in World War II. Whereas by the end of World War II, the entire British army, the entire American army were 100% motorized. Accompanying this audio, I'm going to send you a photo of the German army in World War II, the part of the German army that you didn't see, and you'll see all these German soldiers. They've got all their horses and carts there along with them, and that is how these German soldiers moved. And to give you an idea also of the kind of hardships that the white men of Europe put up with, hardships that will shock you to the core. There was a division of volunteers from Spain who volunteered to fight for the Germans on the Eastern Front, the Blue Division. The Blue Division marched 900 kilometers in 30 days to get to the Eastern Front. I repeat that. The Spanish Blue Division marched 900 kilometers in 30 days to get to the Eastern Front. And putting that into the context of South African terms, the distance from Johannesburg to Cape Town is 1,400 kilometers. Has anybody in Johannesburg considered that we should walk 64% of the distance from Johannesburg to Cape Town on foot in 30 days. No, we would never even think of it. We'd never even conceive of the idea. Yet this is one of just many unbelievable hardships that white men of Europe have put up with in recent times, and in ancient times it was even worse. White people do not appreciate the efforts and the struggles of the whites of Europe. We do not appreciate what the Europeans have gone through. We do not appreciate what our forefathers and our ancestors in Europe were willing to do in order to fight their wars, in order to do certain things. You will be shocked to the core if you had to fully grasp some of the things that white men have done, not only in ancient times, but in recent times like World War II. And even after World War II, if you look at certain rebellions and things that white men from Europe engaged in, whites have done unbelievable things that go totally unappreciated by our entire race. We do not even begin to grasp the difficulties, the bravery, the intelligence, the efforts of other white people. And we sit back like a bunch of armchair idiots and we say, oh, well, you see, the Germans could have won if they only did this, or the French could have won if they only did that, or the Romans could have done this better, or, you know what, most of the time these kinds of comments are completely idiotic to the core. You have no idea what white men have gone through, and you have no idea how white men think and how they fight, and what comes naturally to us. What is our method? How does it work? And what is the logic behind it? And that's what I want to address in this audio. The whites in Southern Africa look at the blacks and we say, oh God, these blacks are just so freaking incredible. These blacks are going to destroy us. These blacks are so good. They're almost our equals. These blacks are so powerful. If you have to look at the blacks through the eyes of a white military analyst and you have to compare these blacks to our methods, you will see these blacks are nothing. These people can be destroyed. And furthermore, the white men of the world have been turned into a bunch of slaves who work for their simple wages, and they don't even begin to grasp the unbelievable military power that our race actually is capable of. If our race just organized even a little bit, we would be smashing whole countries, we'd be taking over entire continents, and you wouldn't need nuclear weapons. You wouldn't need weapons of mass destruction. You could occupy every square inch of entire continents. You could drive your enemies before you. You will send them into a state of panic. You will smash them and rip them apart regularly. In fact, in Adolf Hitler's Table Talk, which is a book that came out that is the result of discussions between Hitler and other high-ranking Germans, Hitler's Table Talk is basically a diary of discussions that Hitler had with his top officers, top people. They used to have discussions at dinner. These discussions were recorded. They had a secretary who wrote the discussions down, and these discussions were written down and signed off by Hitler. And it's known as Hitler's Table Talk. In Hitler's Table Talk, there is a point where Hitler talks about the Romans. Hitler liked the Romans a lot. And the Romans are the very basis for all white armies that exist, because nobody fought more wars and battles for a longer period of time and were successful as the Romans. And Hitler says in the table talk that he fails to see why the Roman legions could not have continued going on and conquering everywhere they went, basically forever. He couldn't see any logical reason why the Roman legions collapsed or should collapse or should be defeated, because their mechanism and their system was so good. And Hitler is right, because the real thing that afflicted the Romans at the end of their empire had nothing to do with military stuff. The Roman Empire was not defeated militarily. What happened to the Roman Empire was that the Roman Empire became divided, weak, pathetic, and the Romans eventually lost the will to fight. I'm not kidding you. They would be invaded by inferior tribes, and the Romans would just refuse to go to battle. They couldn't even call up a Roman army. The Romans lost because the Romans stopped believing in themselves, because the Romans stopped fighting. They stopped fighting. That is the bottom line. Hitler was basically pointing out that if the Romans continued as before, and they continued believing in themselves, and they carried on waging war the way that they used to, that they would have continued to win, and the Roman Empire would have grown even bigger. And he's quite right. For the few of you who have managed to listen to my lecture, 50 Years of Race War in Southern Africa, that I gave earlier this year, in that lecture, I was talking about the War of the Portuguese, the Rhodesians, the Southwest Africans, and the South Africans in Southern Africa over a period of 50 years. And I described the lessons that we learned from each other, how the Rhodesians and South Africans learned from the Portuguese, and then how we went on to develop new methods, how the Rhodesians developed methods, how the South Africans took these methods and took them to the next level, and how in 50 years of warfare, we learned all kinds of things and we developed a whole new style of warfare that worked for us and was unbelievably successful. And at its height, South Africa was the only Western nation, and South Africans can put this feather in their cap. South Africa is the only nation in the entire Western world that dared to fight the Russians directly. A tiny nation on the bottom tip of Africa was the only nation in the whole Western world that dared to take on the Soviet Union face to face and whip their asses and bring all of their stuff to a grinding halt. That is the great feat of the South African Defence Force, a feat that goes completely unrecognized within South Africa by the very people who were part of it, and it's definitely unrecognized by the rest of the Western world and our race. Who would have thought that a country with a population of less than 5 million whites would dare to take on the best of the Soviet Union's technology and actually hurt them badly and bring them and their allies to a grinding halt on multiple occasions and inflict massive damage upon them, including wiping out entire tank forces for the loss of very little. And in that lecture, what I was pointing out was how we evolved, we in Southern Africa, without taking the slightest note of actual history of our race, how we ourselves ended up starting to fight war more and more in the European way. How we started out fighting little terrorist police actions, hunting a few terrorists here, hunting a few terrorists there, and how over time we actually evolved into the Western way of war, and It worked like crazy for us. When the Rhodesians started cross-border raids, the Rhodesians were actually making their first moves into fighting war the Western way. But I will bet you, from all the Rhodesian literature that I've read and from every Rhodesian that I've ever spoken to, I will bet you that not a single Rhodesian went and studied European history in order to arrive at that. In fact, Reed Daly, the man who created the concept for the first mass cross-border raid, himself, when he talks about how he came up with the idea, there is absolutely nothing in his discussions, not even in his own book, where he tells you, "Oh, I went and read a book about the Germans or the Romans or the French or the Portuguese or the Spanish or somebody else, and I learned this from them." No. He simply says to you that he came to the conclusion that this method, this thing would work. As crazy as this idea sounds, it's going to work. And he gives his reason as to why it would work. He says they're not going to expect this. It's the last thing the enemy is expecting. This thing is going to work. And once the Rhodesians started doing it, and they did it more and more and bigger, it worked better and better for them. There was even one battle that the Rhodesian army and the South African army fought in the south of Mozambique that was the biggest battle of the entire Rhodesian War. And it is the only time that the Rhodesian and South African armies fought together in a battle against the blacks. Now let me explain the Western way of war, what it is, how it really works, why it is superior, and why it will work in the future. There is no better system than this. A completely unappreciated fact about Europe that no whites in the world appreciate about Europe, especially the whites outside Europe. Nobody appreciates the kind of stresses and the kind of intense competition that the Europeans underwent among themselves in their many centuries of struggle against each other. And this warfare between the whites of Europe with each other actually allowed them to develop a system of warfare that is the most superior system in the world. The only problem is that there have only been very rare occasions when the Europeans as a whole were united. 99% of the time, the Europeans were fighting against each other, and the British or Russians who were sitting on their borders interfered in their wars, and when they saw one side was winning, they would go and back the other side so that the winner doesn't win a clear victory. This is a trend of European war that's lasted for hundreds of years. The British made a firm policy of it, and whenever the British saw that one side was going to win and take over all of Europe, the British went to tremendous lengths to destroy the winner. They did it with Napoleon, they did it with Hitler, they were doing it even before then. So among themselves, these Europeans were always limited in territory, they were always limited by many factors. And these Europeans spent a great deal of time thinking and working out methods of fighting that could enable them to win, and win quickly and win easily. European war also underwent different styles. Because the Europeans had such high standards, and the competition between them was so intense, these Europeans were highly educated and highly skilled. They were highly educated leaders and commanders, and they were highly skilled as soldiers. So there were times when warfare in Europe wasn't mass warfare. There were times in Europe when warfare was conducted by small armies that were highly professional, a lot like the way the militaries of the world are today. They are very downsized and they are very high tech, very professional. And the Europeans used to conduct wars like that against each other. And when they functioned like this, they played their war like a game of chess. And the war actually consisted of what was called a war of maneuver, where one army would maneuver into a position and the other army would move into a counter position. So, for example, one army might be chasing another army. Then the one army gets onto a nice hill and they've got nice fortifications there. And then the other army can't attack them on the hill because the other army doesn't want to engage in losses. So then what they would do is they might try and maneuver behind the other army to cut off their supply lines. So then the army on the hill, which is about to lose all its forms of supply of food and ammunition or whatever, they would then retreat to a new position. So these armies would be maneuvering around and not a single battle would take place. Not a single battle would take place. They would just be maneuvering around for weeks and months on end because each commander was so cognizant of the situation that it was like a game of chess. And if the one army got the other army into a bad position, then the commander in the bad position wouldn't want to fight because he knows he's going to lose. He's going to suffer losses. He's going to lose. So then he rather moves away. And this is how they fought many wars. Very little fighting and lots of maneuvering. Months in and months out. Armies would move around and you'd have this blob of troops moving around, two big armies of troops maneuvering all the time. This one does this, that one does that. This one tries to outmaneuver the other one in another way. The battles were extremely rare, and battles only took place either when there was a political reason for the battle, which meant that you're fighting the battle for a totally stupid reason. You are fighting the battle maybe because the king has said, you can't carry on doing this, I'm going to run out of money. So you fight the battle because you must either fight the battle or your funding's going to be cut off. Something like that. The other reason for a battle is when the two sides get themselves into a position, and on this occasion, both commanders are quite convinced that they're in a good position. Both commanders actually think, you know what? We stand a chance. We can win. Or they may be thinking, this is the best chance we're ever going to get. And therefore, this is the best place to fight. Even if we maneuver for another 5 years, we're never going to get a chance as good as this. So most battles then take place either because of non-military reasons, cutting off of funds or saving of face, honor. But there are other battles that take place because now you've reached a point where the sides are so equal in the minds of their commanders. Each commander is thinking, I can beat him. In this position, I can beat him. So you'll have one commander who's in the position of defender and he thinks, let them attack me. I'm in a really good position here. They're going to struggle. This is my chance to whip their asses. Then the other commander is thinking, you know what? Even if I have to attack him, I can take him. And that is when a battle takes place. And it takes place because of the miscalculation of one of the commanders. One of the two commanders has made a mistake in his mind. He's miscalculated the situation, and we're going to know who's right by whoever wins the battle. This type of warfare has been very common in, let's call it, the Christian era of war. It is a method of warfare that has predominated since the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. There have been rare occasions where it's gone beyond that, and particular occasions when it did go beyond that were the French Revolution and what we know as World War I and World War II. And both World War I and World War II were not in any way a world war. They were wars aimed at destroying Germany. That's all they were. These were wars aimed at putting Germans in a spot and destroying Germany as a new country. Because Germany as a new country only came into existence in the 1870s. Prior to that, Germans were actually split, and they were split into lots of tiny kingdoms. Germany, as we know it today, as a unified entity, is actually a very new entity. It was only created in the 1870s, and it was the new strongest power in Europe, and the British especially realized that this entity has to be destroyed because this entity would otherwise dominate Europe. Prior to that, the country which dominated Europe was France and also the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Those were the two key countries that dominated Europe. So this, let's call it, Christian way of war. So the Christian way of war, if I could call it that, is a war of small armies, professional armies. They maneuver around a lot, and they don't engage in much fighting. And when they do, it's either due to a miscalculation by one of the commanders or due to some force that's not military. Like the guy might even be running out of supplies. His army might actually be about to fall apart. And he may say, well, you know, this is it for me. This is my only shot. I might as well do it while I've got it. The biggest requirement of an army is logistics. If you don't have food, if you don't have things that can do transport like horses, etc., if you don't have a logistical system, your army isn't going to function. Your army cannot run for extended periods of time. If you lack logistics, then your army can only operate for very short periods of time. And we're going to get to that. But let's call this the Christian way of war. It's basically a kind of warfare that's like a game of chess. Another mass form of war in modern times in the Christian age was the American Civil War. The American Civil War was a lot like the European wars. It was like the War of Napoleon. It was like the wars that we know as World War I and II. So that too is a mass form of warfare. And mass warfare in the Christian age is not a common thing. But in prior times, in the days before Christianity, in pagan times, mass warfare was a big thing, and it was a common thing. And that is where the real methodology of warfare comes from. And that is the form of warfare that is the most superior of all. And every army on the face of the earth right now, whether they know it or not, is based on the Roman army. All the lessons of the Roman army have defined what armies are like in the world, even in Africa. Now, the Western way of war was invented by the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks were actually farmers, and these farmers had border disputes. And these border disputes got very heated, and they eventually worked out a method of fighting because these issues were so critical that these things eventually could not be resolved verbally. And for the record, it is a fact of life that there are many things that are critically important that cannot be resolved through talking. They cannot be resolved through talking. It is a liberal Jewish lie that you can resolve the most important issues through talking. The most important issues in the world, in all of history, in all of time, right to the current time, have always been solved with warfare. There are just things that you cannot resolve through talking, because your enemy is going to say that this thing that you want, you cannot have, and I will not give it to you under any conditions. You will get this over my dead body. End of story. And that is a fact of life. And it exists in the world to this day. And you will see even these Americans who are here for peace and civilization, that they go and they kill people when they need to kill people. And that is how the world works. It's always worked that way, and it always will work that way. The original Greeks who started the Western way of war were farmers. Because they were farmers, they could not leave their crops and their land for long. So they needed a form of warfare that got to a result quickly. They didn't have a lot of time. They didn't have a lot of logistics. They couldn't do things for very long periods of time. So they would get together, they'd form their armies, and they would go and they'd fight. And their armies did not just consist of the young men. They had men up to the age of 50 putting on their armor, and the old men and the young men went together as an armed force, and they fought against the enemy. And the whole purpose of the battle, the two armies would get together, they'd even agree where they're going to fight. They'd even say, okay, there's an open field over there, that's where we're going to meet, that's where we're going to fight. So the two armies would actually arrive, and they would line up, and they would then engage in fighting against each other. They would then maneuver and use tactics to fight each other. So a large amount of what later came out of warfare was actually removed in this original form of warfare. They actually chose the place that they're going to fight. So there was no maneuvering. There was no advantage of territory, which is a critical part of warfare as it later developed. But in that time, they didn't bother with that. They just got their two armies together. They fought it out. Winner takes all. That was that. The battle was quick. It was bloody. It was nasty. They were fighting for their very existence. They were fighting for their pieces of land. That's what they were fighting for. And one could say this is probably where the origin of the concept of blood and soil comes from, which is a very white way of thinking. All white people across the world think like this. This is our thing. You fight for your territory. And it works. So the Greek way of warfare was you get together, you have a very intense battle, and within a few hours at the most, the battle will be over, people will be dead, one side will have won, that's it. You fight your battle, you fight for a day, game over, winner takes all, that's the end of it. Very rare occasions, it might not be such a clear outcome. But mostly, it's a quick fight and it's a decisive outcome. White warfare, therefore, is based on maximum force. It is based on maximum force. It is very intensive. It is very fast. And the goal is smash the other army. If you watch the blacks of Africa, watch the whole of Africa, you will see that the blacks do the opposite. The blacks go and they engage in a soft form of fighting. And the wars of the blacks against each other last decades. It is not uncommon for a serious war in Africa to run for more than 20 years. And they fight now, and they fight then, and they fight this way, and they fight that way, and they fight, and they fight, and they fight, and they fight, and nobody has really won. The white man solved this problem a long time ago. The white Western way was, You fight to win, winner takes all, end of game, that's it, game over. We're going to go and we're going to win, and we're going to win immediately. We're either going to win immediately or we're going to lose immediately, and that's the outcome, and from there onwards, that's how we live. That is how warfare has been practiced in Europe. But because warfare was also between people of the same race, they also had certain codes of conduct, like it was not the done thing to go and rape the women and kill the children. In actual fact, in Western warfare, there were times when the men would go and steal the women and children from the very people they conquered. And you would go and grab the women of the dead men, and you'd bring them into your tribe, and they'd turn into your wives, and you would raise them and their children, and they now belong to you, and they're part of you. So European way of war wasn't so destructive as well. The men might have died, but the women and children passed on to whoever was the winner. And then they became their wives. The women belonged to the strongest men. End of story. Now the Roman army which fought the most was an army that was composed mostly of white men as heavy infantry. In fact, in the history of warfare of our race, the white male's place has always been what you could call heavy infantry. He is armored and armed to his teeth as much as possible. Though this is many times not possible, many times it's not possible. But whenever we can, the white man fights as heavy infantry. And the Roman army was one of the greatest proponents of this mechanism. However, the Roman army fought on different continents, different terrains. It fought against whites, it fought against non-whites. It was one of the most practiced armies and also one of the most intelligent armies in the history of the world. Every Roman soldier was actually a highly skilled guy. The Roman army was a high IQ army, just like the German army in World War II was a high IQ army. These are not stupid guys who are going to war. These are clever guys going to war. And in warfare, having technical skills is very important. The Roman army used a lot of engineering. They had guys in the legions who could make and repair weapons. They could make and repair shoes. They could do all kinds of other skilled activities that the army needed. So once the Greeks had basically set the standard that you need to fight intensely and you get the war over quickly, the real logic behind that is the need to not have lots of logistics. It is, we don't have time to gather enough food so that the army can function for a year. We need to go into battle and we need to fight our battle and get it over with. Because next week we've got to come back, we've got to carry on work in our fields. We can't leave our crops and our animals untended. So the Western way of warfare came about as a solution to a logistical problem. But it was also a solution in the sense that you fight it out and you smash somebody. So unlike the blacks who fight for 25 years without reaching a conclusion, the whites go, they fight for a week, the army gets together, they go and they march, they maneuver around, they fight each other, it's over, they come back home, the dead are buried, and that's that. The whites sort out the problem, they reach a conclusion, and now they don't have to fight for the next 5 years, or however long it is. Whites reach a conclusion and then they carry on with their daily work. It's a quick form of warfare and it gets the job done and you continue because you've got to work. Remember, these whites were peasants. It wasn't like they had 100 black workers running their farm while they're away on war. That style of warfare is the knight. The knight in the times of Christianity. The knight was like that. The knight had his serfs working his land. the knight could get on his horse, he'd have his servants who go with him, and he would fight. But he's got a whole structure busy at home, and the knight has got his farm functioning while he's away. Whereas for the Romans and the Greeks, that wasn't the case. They were peasants. They had to go and work in order to feed themselves. Now, the Roman army, which fought more than any other army and fought for longer than any other army and was victorious more often than any other army in history. The Roman army fought all nations, all races, under all kinds of conditions. They fought in deserts, they fought in the snow, they fought in forests, they fought all over the place. And at the core of the Roman army was heavy infantry, composed of Roman men armed and trained as a proper fighting force. However, this army had various shortcomings. And the way that the Romans solved their shortcomings was they had allies. And so the Roman army, when it fought in different places, it had additional troops in it who were non-Roman. The Romans, for example, weren't big on cavalry. Though they had some horses with them, they weren't big on cavalry. The core of their army was heavy infantry, men with armor, with shields, with spears, with swords. That was the main Roman soldier. He was a very effective soldier, and he worked in a very specific way. So you had heavy infantry that worked very well, highly trained. These are civilians who are highly trained. The Roman army wasn't just a professional army. The Roman army also used call-up. So if they were in big trouble, they would call men up and form new formations, and they'd go to war. But the auxiliaries were a very interesting adaptation of the Romans, and they fought in many, many different places, sometimes very far away from home. So what they would do is when they're in another country or among another race, so they might find some allies there, and then they might bring in some military units from those allies, or they would hire other troops from other countries who would carry out certain functions for them. Often the functions of the auxiliaries were cavalry, but they also included having slingers and other light troops. The auxiliaries were light troops. They were used for scouting. They were used for all the kinds of light fighting and other assistance needed for the heavy infantry. But the white male of the Roman army, he was the heavy infantry, and he did the heavy fighting. These auxiliaries are a very interesting adaptation of the Romans. They had auxiliaries from far and wide in their armies, and Roman armies could be very different because depending on where they fought, they had different auxiliaries. But always the heart of the Roman army was the heavy infantry, and when it comes down to the real fighting, that's where the heavy infantry steps in. And everybody else is just adding to and assisting the heavy infantry. It's the heavy infantry that's going to rip the enemy apart. The heavy infantry remains to this day, all armies of the world, the infantry core of it, or white men with guns, these white guys are going to do the heavy fighting. The infantry are the core of every army. The infantry are the core of every army. They are the most versatile unit. They have all kinds of difficult jobs to do, and there are many things you cannot mechanize, but the infantry form the heart and soul of the army. They are the most flexible unit of all. Now, the high-level strategy of the white way of war is the following. You have two nations. Each nation has an army. Each nation is vulnerable. It's got cities, it's got civilians, it's got bridges, it's got farms. Each state is vulnerable, and the only thing that provides defense is the army. So the way that Western warfare evolved, and Napoleon was the highest exponent of this form of warfare, is that Napoleon focused on smashing the enemy army. You smash the enemy army because once you destroy the enemy army, then the enemy state is completely helpless. Once you've smashed the enemy army, it doesn't matter how big that state is, it doesn't matter how rich they are, it doesn't matter what terrain they've got. Once you've smashed their army, they are totally vulnerable. Thereafter, you can go and kill anybody you want to kill. Nobody will be able to stop you. Not the police, not the masses. Nobody can stop an army. Okay? When you've got an army and that army is operating together as a single entity, that army cannot be stopped. It cannot be stopped unless its supplies are maybe cut. But as long as it's got a means of getting supplies, a army as a single entity, imagine an army as a big blob, a big mass of white men. Once you've got that big blob of white men together, they are armed, they're functioning as a big structure. Let's say you've got an army, let's say for argument's sake, 50,000 men. You've got 50,000 armed white men, and they are physically gathered together and they are able to move, either through walking or through a combination of walking and driving. But whatever you've got 50,000 armed men. And they are moving as a single body. They may be moving down different roads, but they are moving together and they are working together as one unit. Once you've got this army, and this army has smashed the enemy army, then what happens is that the enemy is completely helpless. The enemy is completely helpless. It doesn't matter how big they are, doesn't matter how rich they are. If you've ripped their army to pieces and you've broken it up, whatever remnants of that army manage to gather together, whatever new people they can manage to gather, once your army has physically smashed and defeated the enemy army in even a single battle, and this is why the big battle is the critical thing. It takes us back to the Greek way. You get your army and you get your entire army to fight one big battle. You fight a big battle and you overcome the enemy army. Let's say you manage to kill 20% of the enemy troops. Many armies will break. They'll break and the troops will flee for their lives. They will break and flee long before you even get to having killed 20% of them. Many armies will break and flee before they've even lost a tenth of their men. And when I say 10% casualties, I'm not saying 10% are dead. Normally in warfare, for every one dead, there are two injured. So an army will break up and run for its life when it's lost maybe 3% of its soldiers in battle, 7% of its soldiers are injured, and the rest of them will run for their lives. That is how warfare actually works. Men are not going to go and fight to the last man, last round. This is not how warfare is done. In the pagan times, the men were much tougher and casualties could be much higher than in modern times. In pagan times, armies could fight and a third of the army could get killed. But that was because the white men in those days were way tougher than any men are today. Not just white men, but all men. So if you've managed to meet the greatest force that the enemy can amass, and you can smash that force, and break that force, break its cohesion, break its morale, Those who flee, you hunt them down and you try and kill them or imprison them. And by the way, entire armies have also surrendered. If you do it right, you can even get the entire army to surrender. Surrender is a nice win-win, because surrender means you don't have to fight them. So if you can get them into a position where they actually surrender to you, then you take their weapons and you make them prisoners and you see to it that they can't get out, get away, and become a military force again. You can actually then use them as slaves. If you are very good and you've managed to hurt and scare your enemy a lot, let's say you've managed to smash their main army, and you're now chasing down the remnants, and you catch a whole bunch of them gathering together, and you outnumber them, and you surround them, they might decide, you know what, we're not going to fight, we're going to call it a day. So once you've smashed an army, or you've caught parts of an enemy army, and you've managed to get them to surrender, those are big wins. All you do, you take their weapons, you enslave them, and you put them into the rear, and you make them go and do work that's useful for you. Anybody who gives you problems, you kill them, and it's way simple. An army is a structure that is capable of maximum force. And so if your army has smashed the enemy army, it means that there's no other military force in that country that can now resist you. Even if they gathered all the policemen together, even if they raised new armies, the armies would be weaker, they would be worse trained. And so this is the beauty of smashing the enemy army, preferably in either a single battle or two or three battles, and then you break them apart. You know, maybe the first battle is somewhat inconclusive and you manage to catch them again, and next time you really rip them apart, and then their morale is broken, they run for their lives. And once you start breaking their cohesion and they start running away, that's when you can sweep them up, capture them, enslave them, make them prisoners of war, take their weapons. Because that's another thing about warfare, is you steal everything that used to belong to your enemy. You steal everything that belonged to them. And also, depending on how you move your army, you can steal the supplies that you need. That's also another way of continuing and moving forward, is you can steal or have as an objective, a military objective, the seizure of supplies and equipment that you need for your army. But warfare, as practiced by Napoleon, who I think was its highest exponent, Napoleon focused all his energy on the enemy army. Once you smash the enemy army and you've defeated them, the entire country is at your mercy. Once your army has smashed their army, there is no other violent force that can stop you. You can do what you want to do. If somebody rebels in a village or a town, nobody is stronger than you. You send your army, you go and you smash them. So once you've defeated their army, all their citizens are at your mercy. And it doesn't matter how many of them there are. You have got the weapons. You've got even more weapons now. You've even got people who've changed sides. These are the kinds of things that come out of it. Once you are dominant as a military force in a country, everybody else is at your mercy. You can kill whomever you want to kill. End of story. And it doesn't matter whether they come at you with guerrilla tactics. There are counters to guerrilla tactics. Guerrilla warfare is not the strongest form of warfare. The Western way is the strongest form of warfare. Even if guerrillas come and attack you and you can't catch the guerrillas, you can go and murder somebody as a reprisal. So you can say, okay, there were guerrillas who came and they attacked us here in this town. and they killed some of our people. We don't know who the guerrillas are, but it took place in this town. Let's kill everybody. So you go and you kill everybody. So that is now a lesson to the rest of the country. Sure, you want to attack us? Go for it. Whoever attacks us, whether we catch them or if you don't help us to catch them, we're going to kill somebody. If you kill 100 of our people, we're going to come and we're going to kill 2,000 of yours. And we don't care who they are. And every time we're attacked, we're going to do this. You will find that very quickly everybody loses their appetite for violence. When you are the dominant force, you will find that people on the other side lose their appetite for violence very, very quickly. You will also find that there are many who will suddenly come to you and say, oh, but we were your friends all along. You are our liberators. You have come to save us. I'm not joking with you. People do this all the time. You invade a place and the people say, oh God, we're so glad you're here. We were waiting for you. Now, it doesn't matter whether they are lying to you or whether their new loyalty to you is on the spur of the moment or whatever. The point is that you've now got people who are either willing to give you money or supply you with stuff, or you can now tax them. The bottom line is that if you can create a force that's strong enough to smash the maximum force that your enemy can amass, and your force remains a cohesive group, your army functions like a big cohesive team, you can do many things. One of the misconceptions that literally every white male on the planet has is that when you have an army, that you need to take your army and you spread your army out across the country. This is not the best way to fight. The best way to fight is that your army must gather itself together as a single force. It doesn't matter how big your territory is. Your entire army must function as one entity. Your army must be in one location. Now, armies don't necessarily all get together and every man stands next to each other. There are reasons why they don't do that, because of the evolution of weaponry. Weaponry and the dangers of certain weapons are what causes armies to spread out a bit. But even so, an army can move as a single force. Napoleon, for example, would have an army of 200,000 men. 200,000 men wouldn't march down one road. That's not possible. So what Napoleon had is he broke his army into groups that he called a corps. And each corps marched down a different set of roads and they moved in parallel with each other. But as these armies marched down separate roads, they would gather together whenever they needed to. So if they started running into an enemy force, they would then gather together and focus on that enemy force. So Napoleon's armies, like the German armies, like other proper armies that functioned properly, these armies would gather together, sometimes, like I say, 200,000 men, sometimes even bigger. And this group of 200,000 men are functioning as one entity. And that is the key and the secret to how you fight war the Western way. When you have your army operating as a single entity, then you do not need to occupy the entire country. And it's bad tactics to occupy the entire country. To take your army and split your army up and have 10 men here and 100 men there and 1,000 men over, this is stupid. Okay, you don't do it this way. You only do those things for very specific reasons and only for very limited purposes. The real secret of fighting the Western way is to fight as a single entity. So even if you have your army of 200,000, you can have some guys over here that are guarding this, others are busy scouting over there, but the army as a whole is a single entity, and the entire entity is functioning as a single unit. When you operate like this, your goal is that you want to keep your army as a mass together so that it can apply maximum force for the battles that are due to take place. The bigger your maximum force is, the quicker you're going to win. You might even win bloodlessly. Enemies might surrender to you because they see how many of you there are. And the few who do fight you will easily be overwhelmed by you. So once you've got your army functioning as a single entity, you don't even need to defend your entire country, actually. And the best example of this is the Seven Years' War with King Frederick the Great. King Frederick the Great fought a war where the biggest nations in Europe attacked him. And his army was not big enough to fight them all at the same time. And Frederick the Great said the following, which is absolutely true. He said, if you defend everything, you defend nothing. What he meant was, if you take your army and you split your entire army up and you have some troops in this town and some troops in that town, you're never going to have a single cohesive force that is capable of fighting an enemy army. Your men are always going to be vastly outnumbered. Your men are never going to be in a position where they can actually smash and break an enemy army. And therefore, you are stuck with a problem. You cannot win. So what Frederick the Great did was he would gather his men together as a single force. And he would leave parts of his country completely undefended. In fact, he even lost his capital. He ruled a country known as Prussia, and Prussia later became Germany. The capital of Prussia is Berlin. You think of it as the capital of Germany, but it was the capital of Prussia before Germany existed. Frederick the Great even left Berlin undefended, and enemy armies moved into Berlin, tore it apart, and Frederick the Great didn't bother. His goal all along was to keep his army together as a functioning entity. Because as long as he could keep his army together as a functioning entity, it would be big enough to take on all comers. So his army would run between the different enemy armies, and he'd chase this one down, try and corner them and smash them. And he'd ignore others. He'd ignore others. He wouldn't care. The others can be tearing up his country. He didn't care. His focus was always find an enemy army and defeat them. Frederick the Great fought the Seven Years' War. In all that time, Frederick only fought 16 battles. Although 16 battles is a lot. He fought 16 big battles and he only won half of them. Yet, he managed to survive. It was an unbelievable feat. He was very lucky in the end. His huge enemies, there were many huge enemies, and his huge enemies eventually just gave up. And that was how he survived. But never at any time did he let his army be defeated. Even when his army was defeated, he always kept it together. He always kept it cohesive. And Frederick the Great was aggressive even when he lost battles. He actually scared his enemies to such a degree that even if he lost a battle, his enemies were often afraid to try and tackle him again. He was so determined. Napoleon was a big believer in the methods of Frederick the Great, but Frederick the Great is physical proof that you don't need an army to occupy an entire country. The armies Existence and the army as a group is all that matters. Everything else is secondary. You gather the army together, you feed the army, you maneuver the army, you fight with the army, you do everything you can to protect and strengthen the army. The army as an existing entity. Then you take that army and you find whatever enemy it is that you need to tear apart, and you go and you tear them apart. And if you are facing multiple armies, let's say there are three armies that are big and strong and they can match your army. You don't let the three armies get together, form one unit and come and attack you. What you do is you go and you find one of those enemy armies and you smash it. Then after you've smashed that army, you take your army and you find the next one and you smash the next one. Then once you've smashed them, you smash the final one. So you can fight somebody who's three times as strong as you by simply focusing your army together, hitting one of the enemy units, one of the enemy armies, ripping them apart, and then you go and you rip the next one apart and the next one apart. And chances are, if you've ripped one of them apart, everybody else already is starting to get demoralized on the enemy side. And by the time you get to the second one, many of them will already be scared. Some of them will start running. By the time you get to the third army, your reputation will be so hideous that there will be troops who will defect. And by the way, in warfare, there are large numbers of troops who just freaking run away. They run away even before the battle has started. I assure you, men do not want to die. Men can become extremely scared. Even the Roman army had moments when it became extremely scared. There were times when all armies have suffered from extreme fear, because fear is a part and parcel of warfare. So when you've smashed the maximum forces that the enemy can amass against you, then who else is there to fight? Then what you do is you can take your army, you can break your army up, and you can say, okay, you go over there, you take care of that city, you take care of that city, you take care of that city. If ever again a time comes where you face a huge threat, you then just concentrate your armies again. You then bring everybody back to a single point and you say, listen, everybody, we've got to get together. We've got to go fight over there. We need everybody. We're all going to go and function there. That is how you actually fight warfare the Western way. You abandon things, or you only leave the very lightest defenses, like roads, for example. A road is actually a thing that you can easily obstruct. A road is something that you can easily control. In many places, you are limited by the number of roads there are, especially here in Africa. If you block a road properly, you can stop almost an entire army. If you go and you blow up a bridge, for example, if you go and blow up a bridge that is over a critical river, let's say there's a big river and there's one bridge and it's the only bridge for 100 kilometers. You go and you blow that bridge up. And how is that army going to get across? Or if they try to get across, you can put a single battalion. Let's say you go and put 1,000 troops on the other side. You blow up the bridge, you put 1,000 troops on the other side. How is an entire army going to get across the river to those 1,000 troops? Those 1,000 troops can shoot them if they try to cross in boats. They can shoot them if they try and swim across. That 1,000 men can hold back an entire army. So one of the ways that you can defend places is you find choke points. You find choke points and you start blowing them up or blocking them. You build fortifications. You can bring in bulldozers and you can bring in sand or rocks or whatever, and you can make yourself defenses. Soil as a defense is very good. It works very well. It's worked all through history. People have been building walls and ditches made of nothing but pure soil. With bulldozers, you can go and build yourself a wall. The Roman army built fortifications that were tens of kilometers long, and they did it using nothing but shovels. The Roman army at various times built fortifications, hasty fortifications in wartime, using nothing but shovels, and their walls were sometimes 20 kilometers long and even longer. I think once they built a wall perhaps as long as 40 kilometers. They didn't have bulldozers, they did it with shovels. Roman soldiers had shovels, they also brought in slaves. There are many ways to create choke points, especially in the modern world. There are many choke points that you can create. You can block things off. So let's say your army leaves and it goes off on an operation 500 kilometers away. You go and you blow up all the things you need to blow up. You create the hasty defenses that you need to create. You then go and stick a couple of thousand men there to protect it. And the rest of your army goes off 500 kilometers away to go and tear up the real enemy army that you want to tear up. There are many ways in which you can create defenses in this modern age. It's easier than ever. You can block things. You can create defenses. And another part of military stuff is logistics. You need to be able to feed your army, whereas they also need to be able to feed their people. And if your army is smaller or your army is more efficient, then you don't need that much in the form of logistics. And everything I'm describing is land warfare. We've not even got into air warfare and the potential of air for combat. In this modern day and age, the possibilities for mass warfare by whites is something beyond belief. Whites have got technology in their hands. They've got things that they can lay their hands on. That if they organized and formed a militia army, and that militia army acted like a proper army, it functioned as a unit, as a single unit with singular purposes. Find the strongest enemy concentration, destroy it. Find the second biggest enemy concentration, destroy that. And within a short while, the enemy is broken. You can do what you want with them. You can take your army. You can go and dominate wherever you need to dominate. You can hunt down the survivors. You can execute anybody that you need to execute. In this modern day and age, whites have got so much technology in their hands that it's actually shocking the power that the common man has. But whites don't think in military terms, and they don't think that they can fight and defeat huge armies. The reality of the matter is that whites across the Western world have got enough power to actually destroy their own professional armies. Not only can they defeat the professional army of their own country, they can seize the entire country without any problem. The people who are the most armed to the teeth, who could retake every inch of their continent, are the Americans. The Americans are sitting with a minimum of 20 million weapons in their hands. Most of those weapons are seriously advanced weapons, I must tell you. And nobody even thinks of how it is that you take this force of white men and you just use the tools that are at your disposal and you can take your entire country back. The Americans are in the best situation to take their country back. The Europeans also are in the same position. The population of the whites is big enough. The whites are actually the most outnumbered are the whites of Africa. But otherwise, all other whites can easily seize their countries back through military force. Through proper military force, it's doable. You'll be able to fight a proper army. You'll be able to overwhelm them. as long as you stick to the white man's way of warfare. And the best example of this kind of fighting is actually the Napoleonic Wars, because in there you had civilians being rushed into combat to fight professional armies. And all that Napoleon did was he took these civilians and he created a structure that was able to actually go into battle and beat actual professional armies. And he did it over and over again for 20 years. He fought all sorts of countries, all combinations of allies, and he tore them apart again and again and again. In this age of aircraft, nobody even talks about the possibilities of aircraft. Air power in future warfare is very, very potent. People aren't even thinking of the possibilities of air power. No, you don't need a stealth bomber that costs $2 billion. No, you don't need that sort of thing. When you've got enough people and you've got a big enough structure and they gather together and they are able to engage in a big push, they can do a lot. The only downside to them is if foreign powers start coming and bringing in other troops or supplies or equipment, and your army now has to carry on and fight year in and year out. That is the only time when you can be beaten, is when other countries start using their resources to build up forces against you. That is the only thing that presents a problem. And that is how the Germans were eventually defeated, was by bringing in the industry, science, and masses of people from all over the world in order to come and defeat them. But again, the key in the white way of war is you gather your army and you fight the biggest force that the enemy can amass. Once you start smashing that force, then it's game over. From there onwards, you start dominating the country. It doesn't matter how big the population is. The fact is, if you've got the maximum military force, it doesn't matter whether your army is 20,000 men in size and there are 20 million civilians against you, your 20,000 will be able to hurt them, slaughter them, massacre them, chase them. You'll be able to make life hell for them. You'll eventually have them screaming for you to stop killing them. These things have been done before. It's nothing mysterious. The point is that you must have a force that when it goes into battle, it can break the strongest single force that the other side has. Once you achieve that, and that in and of itself, you don't need vast masses of tanks, etc. Returning to the German Army of World War II, the German Army of World War II did have very high-tech weapons, but they didn't have it in large quantities. So the German army had high-tech weapons, and then they spent the additional money on getting a few of the high-tech weapons. You'll see that the Germans even had some of the best tanks that were produced in World War II. They just didn't have them in large enough numbers, that's all. So you mustn't imagine that, let's say, the German Panther tank, which was one of the finest German weapons of World War II, that the Germans needed 30,000 Panthers in order to win. No, the Germans had small numbers of tanks backed up by vast numbers of infantry. And all that the Germans did was they took their best weapons and they said, okay, in order to crush our enemy, we need to take our best weapons and smash the enemy over there. When we break the enemy there, then we're going to be able to tear them apart. Then we're going to break their cohesion. Then the other guys are going to come and do this. And then their whole defense system is going to collapse. That is how you actually fight. You don't go and line up a million men against another million men. You actually look for their weak spots. And in the case of the Germans, for example, the Germans focused on logistics. The German blitzkrieg, as we in the English-speaking world know it, the German blitzkrieg was actually about smash a hole through the enemy line, scare a whole bunch of people so that they block the roads, then you cut off their supplies. When you cut off their supplies, then their army can only fight and function for a certain period of time, and then the army is going to collapse. That is how they collapsed the British and French armies in 40 days in France. They went, they bust through a part of the line, they then sliced through the back of it, they went through the back, which was weakly defended, they sliced through the back, cut off all the roads, the army then lost all its supplies, and then the armies had to pretty much stop fighting because they ran out of ammunition and supplies. And also, once you slice off the enemy's communications and logistics, or you break their structure, then the army also becomes dysfunctional because it's not getting orders, it doesn't have commanders at the top. Basically, what you do is you force chaos on your enemy. Your enemy goes crazy, he doesn't know what to do, and then that's when you beat him. You beat him because you are the master of the chaos, and he is the victim of the chaos. You know what you're doing, you know why you're doing it, you know your goal. He doesn't know what's going on, he gets scared, he starts freaking out, and that's how it goes. Most men stop fighting for one reason or another. Men do not die by the millions. They don't fight to the last man. Men do not die by the millions. They run away. They get scared. Even trained men with guns, they run away and they hide. Before battles, before big battles, even white men would abandon their armies. They would suddenly disappear the day before the battle. Hundreds of men suddenly disappear, or thousands even, would disappear. They don't want to be in tomorrow's battle. They don't want to stand a chance of getting killed. Most men do not want to die. And that is the important thing. It is those who are willing to go and fight versus the large numbers who are not willing to fight. So you find the enemy, the part of the enemy that does want to fight, and you rip them apart. Then you'll find that 90% of the rest of them don't want to fight. And you've won. So you don't need a million men in every city. All you need is one army. Even if that army was, let's say, 100,000 white men strong, you need one army, and that army functions as an entity. And that army can then move. It can move left and right, forwards and backwards, north and south. And that army can now start engaging things. You actually use the army to start hunting for ways to destroy your enemy, to stop them from functioning, and to break them. And that is where strategy comes into the whole thing. That is what the Germans were good at. The Germans would say, I need to go and smash that in order to get there. Napoleon was the same. Napoleon's focus, because Napoleon was fighting First World armies, Napoleon would actually focus on the enemy army and smash it. Once he smashed it, all resistance is over. That's it, game over. There are very rare occasions where that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case in Russia, that wasn't the case in Spain, but in 90% of all other situations, that was the case. Is warfare possible in the future by civilians? Can whites overthrow entire countries? Can whites conquer entire continents? The answer is yes. Can the American military be defeated and overthrown? Absolutely, definitely. If enough white men in America wanted to do it, it's totally possible. In fact, if enough white men in America were willing to do it, many would actually leave the army and go and fight on the side of the people fighting for freedom. Then maybe for once they'd actually be fighting for a worthwhile cause. Can the whites seize back Europe? Can they even seize back Britain? That's the biggest question. And the answer is actually yes. The answer is actually yes. If enough white men wanted to do it, they can do it. If there are enough white men who all agree on the same thing and they decide, you know what, we've got to form an army, we've got to clean out our country, we've got to take every inch of it back, and the answer would be yes. And we will expel and kill our lying politicians, scum, and the elite that have been working against us. We will take the elite, we will tie them to poles like the Romans, and we will break their ribs and leave them there to die slowly for the next 4 days in excruciating pain. Well, you know, that's very doable. It is very doable. It only requires that enough white men decide to gather together and fight as a team. From there onwards, the white race can conquer entire continents. Do not be concerned by hundreds of millions or even billions of people standing in your way. The white methods work. They work very well. They worked in pagan times, long before the kinds of technology that exists today. We've got so much technology. There are so many tactics and weapons that can be invented and improvised that can be used in quantity. A final point about the Germans. The Germans invented special weapons where high tech was useful. And then when the Germans needed weapons for the mass of soldiers, they then looked into what is the best way to do that. How can we arm the mass of soldiers in a simple way that makes them functional? And that is also very easy. In the modern day, there are so many options. There are so many ways to do these things. And there are so many weapons that can be improvised. Really nice things that can be improvised that are very, very potent in warfare. Lots of that stuff can be done. So don't believe that the white race is finished. Don't believe the white male is finished. All that's happening is that every time strong white men get together who are strongly determined in order to do something, the Jews and the liberals try to nip it in the bud so that those white men can't get off and get going. And once they get going, the Jews and liberals try to find ways to trip them up and try to find ways to stop them. That's all. But the white male as a fighting force, the white man as a future conqueror, the white man as a future occupier of territories, seizing new terrain, gaining territory that whites need, very easy stuff. Easy, easy. We're an old race. We've been around the block many times. We've figured all these things out. Everything's in our history. And like Napoleon says, history is inspiration. You will find your inspiration in history. Napoleon said that. He said you will find inspiration in history, and it's totally true. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.